This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to More or Less on the BBC World Service. I'm Ruth Alexander. The Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences was awarded jointly this week to Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Michael Kremer of Harvard. To find out more about their work, I spoke to our favourite economist, Tim Harford. He usually presents More or Less, of course, but for one day a year, he takes off his presenter hat and puts on his economist hat, a rare treat, because he does prefer to remain undercover. Tim, always a pleasure interviewing you for your own show.
The pleasure's all mine.
Thank you for being here. So tell us about the winners. Why did they win?
I'm so pleased that this trio has won. They are amazing. They are young. They are dynamic. They're doing just brilliant work. There are a lot of things they could have won for, but in particular, they were cited for promoting experiments in development economics. So the big idea here is the same way in which you would run a randomized controlled trial in medicine, an idea that we've got very used to, was first popularized after the Second World War. You could do that in economics too.
So what kind of trials have they done?
The first one that Michael Kremer did with a student of his called Edward Miguel was testing what sort of interventions might improve the performance of school kids in Kenya. In this particular region of Kenya, maybe we should supply them with textbooks, maybe we should supply them with blackboards, writing materials. What actually worked was treating the children for worms so they wouldn't get particular kinds of parasitic worms. And the reason this was turned out to be so effective was because it meant they didn't miss school, they were better nourished, they were better able to concentrate, and it was incredibly cheap. And not only was it incredibly cheap, but once you start treating some children for worms, even the children who aren't getting worms are less likely to pick up the infection because it's contagious. So this was the first randomized controlled trial that really broke through in development economics. Actually, that particular trial is quite controversial. I think we covered it in More or Less once as to whether they really found what they thought they found, whether the trial was as convincing in the long run. But the point is, they did it, and then Banerjee and Duflo came along with Kremer and really industrialized the process and started running many, many more trials, long range trials, trials in different parts of the world, really trying to generate useful information that could then lead to better policies. Because there's enormous amount of money spent by the aid industry. And I think people quite reasonably want to know whether this money is doing any good.
It seems quite surprising in a way that their work has been such a breakthrough to try and to go and run trials and find the evidence about what works. And yet it was a breakthrough.
Well, I remember the very first time I appeared on More or Less as a guest was arguing that we should do more of this stuff. It was about 13, 14 years ago. We should do more of this stuff. It's really useful. We should do more of it in the UK. We should do more of it internationally. So
turns out the Nobel Committee agrees with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was absolutely right all along. But I got the idea from actually talking to a colleague of Banerjee and Duflo. They have an organisation at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology called the Poverty Action Lab. And I spoke to somebody from the Poverty Action Lab who was explaining this idea to me. And of course, once it's explained, you go, well, of course, yeah, that's a great way to generate evidence. It wasn't easy to sell this idea in medicine, and it's not easy to sell it in economics.
Does it almost seem too simple?
It's partly the sense that people already know what works, and it's then...
Or they think they do.
They think they do. They think they know what works, and then it's a really controversial move to say, well, only half of the people are going to get this cool new intervention. Mm. I remember getting into a big argument with the economist Jeffrey Sachs, very famous, very celebrated economist, who had a huge development project he was trying to push called the Millennium Villages Project. And he didn't evaluate it using a randomized trial. And Duflo actually used to work with Sachs. She was a research assistant for Sachs. And she argued that he was doing it wrong. If he didn't run this as a randomized trial, then he wasn't going to generate good information. He wasn't going to be able to prove that his idea worked. And Sachs always said, I know it works. It's unethical to run the trial. Everybody should get this good stuff that I'm advocating. And I mean, this is a very common argument in medicine too.
Did she win that argument?
She has won the argument. She and Banerjee and Kremer have won the argument in as much as it is now, I think, quite difficult to run the kind of project that could be randomised without randomization. People ask, well, why not? We need to generate the information. We need to know what works.
There's another notable thing about Esther Duflo, and that's that she's only the second female economist to win the Nobel Memorial Prize. Why?
Actually, I would say she's the first female economist to win the Nobel Memorial Prize because Eleanor Ostrom, who is amazing, or was amazing, sadly, no longer with us. Eleanor Ostrom, who won the first prize given to a woman, was not an economist. She was a political scientist. And Eleanor Ostrom was not as well known in economics, not as well respected in economics as I think she should be. So Duflo, I think, is arguably the first female economist to win the Nobel Prize.
Why has it taken so economics? Long?
It's partly that economics, I think, has a diversity problem. We don't have enough women studying economics at any level, not at the level of professorship, not at the level of PhD, not at the level of undergraduates. So that's a problem. It is partly the fact that Nobel Prizes tend to be won by people who are quite old, by people who are at the end of their careers. Duflo is 46.
Yeah, so that's notable that she's rather young.
She is easily the youngest winner, easily the youngest winner of the Nobel Prize. So that's quite striking. And so it is partly reflecting the past of economics. The Nobel Prizes partly reflect who was doing amazing work 30 years ago. Not in this case. It reflects who's doing amazing work right now. But without a doubt, economics needs to appeal to a wider range of people and needs to take diversity seriously because it's a great subject. It should appeal to everyone and it will be a stronger subject if it does.
Tim Harford, the undercover economist at the Financial Times. Tim mentioned his first ever More or Less interview and an item we made about the controversy surrounding the randomised controlled trial on worms and education in Kenya. Those are both coming up later in this podcast. The diversity problem in economics is very real, and across the world there are now people trying to do something about it. This week in London, the Royal Economic Society launched their attempt to improve diversity in economics. I spoke to the co-chair of the campaign, Professor Sarah Smith, head of the School of Economics at the University of Bristol.
I think it's probably fair to say that in many countries, women are underrepresented in economics, and actually not just women, but I think economics is seen as having a broader diversity problem and not attracting students, for example, from a wide range of backgrounds. So that's one of the things we're trying to tackle in our campaign.
Where does the problem originate? I mean, I actually have a confession to make to you, which is that I considered doing economics at school, but my older brother, who studied it at school, cautioned me against it. He said, don't do it. It's boring.
It's
so
boring.
Is the problem that economics has an image problem?
Well, I think so, yeah. So if you take the UK and you think about obviously people study economics in their final 2 years of school, economics is quite popular. So about 1 in 10 students take economics. It's about as popular as geography. But the gender composition is very different. So about 1 in 6 boys take it compared to 1 in 17 girls. So I think when you see those statistics, you realise that if we're never going to solve gender diversity among professional economists unless we can do something about attracting a more diverse set of students to study economics in the first place.
So why do you think girls aren't choosing to study economics?
If you ask 15 to 17-year-olds to tell you what 3 words they'd use to say what economics is about, they say money, finance and banking. You might say, well, that sounds a bit boring. Our view is that if you say, well, actually, economics is about understanding the causes of poverty. It's about developing practical steps to improve education. It's about tackling climate change. It's about understanding inequality. It's about globalisation and development. I think that would make it seem like quite a different subject.
In the UK, one subject that girls choose a lot is psychology. And there's a far bigger gender disparity between the numbers of girls and boys choosing this subject. Does it matter if we have a lot of female psychologists and a lot of male economists?
Diversity matters for every academic discipline because we know that you need a very diverse range of opinions and perspectives in order to foster intellectual growth. So having diversity within psychology and economics is important because it's going to lead to the strongest academic disciplines. I think it matters particularly in economics because of the link between economics and policy making. And we know from survey evidence that male and female economists have slightly different views on, for example, is the current state of the labour market fair, the efficacy of government intervention. So I think if you get a very narrow set of people in economics, then it actually matters because it's going to affect the policies that are made because economists are advising on those policies and they're not reflecting the society that they're trying to help shape.
Professor Sarah Smith. In his interview, Tim mentioned he'd talked about randomised control trials on his very first More or Less appearance, not as a presenter, but as an interviewee, way back in 2006. So we thought you might like to hear what Tim had to say about randomised control trials when he was a mere slip of a lad and More or Less was presented by Andrew Dilnot.
We asked Tim Harford, author of The Undercover Economist, to tell us why it mattered. And he started with an example close to home.
It's 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's a typical morning for the Harford family. I'm trying to get my daughter to eat her toast. She wants to watch a video. So I'm dealing with the same problem that all parents deal with. How do you get your own way? Do you cajole? Do you negotiate? Or do you just thrash the little blighter? It would be nice to know exactly which of these methods was going to work, but we don't know. But with a lot of situations, it actually is possible to carry out a proper controlled trial. And when you do carry out a controlled trial, it's surprising what you can learn.
Mum, I don't want to play a ball.
Inchworm. If you want to know what really works in development, what really works, for instance, to improve education levels,
you and your arithmetic.
That's something we know surprisingly little about.
Probably go far.
The typical way of working out whether the money is cost-effective is you look at an aid program, maybe handing out textbooks or handing out flip charts to schools. You look at the schools that receive the textbooks and you ask whether the kids do better in those schools. And the answer is that they do. The problem is, what happens if it's the better connected schools, the better resource schools, that are the ones who get the flip charts? Even if it's just the schools who are most desperate to improve, maybe they got a new headmaster in, then this result is entirely spurious. The textbooks, the flip charts, they're not actually doing anything. They're just correlated with the resources or with the enthusiasm of the school. If you really want to find out, well, you need to do something a bit tougher. You need to hand out textbooks, flip charts to some schools, and you need to deny them to other schools, and you need to choose those schools not based on who is most eager to be involved in the programme, not based on who's most cooperative, but purely at random, because it's only by doing it at random that you isolate the effect of your aid programme and find out whether it's really working. When economists looked at whether those flip charts, for instance, were working, they found they made no difference at all. When they looked at the effect of textbooks in Kenyan schools, they found that textbooks did help the smarter children, but they didn't help the children who really needed the help because those children couldn't read.
Inchworm, measure.
Sometimes surprising results come out of randomised trials. For instance, one thing that has worked in Kenya is supplying worming tablets to schools.
You'll probably go far.
What you find is before you supply the worming tablets, the children are undernourished, they're too sick to go to school, when they are at school they don't concentrate, and economists have found, using the randomised controlled trial, that for just $3.50 you can get a child into school for a whole year. That's far more cost-effective than most of the other methods that have been tried, and it's so counterintuitive. It took a randomised trial to prove that it worked. So when I'm trying to work out what to do with my daughter in the morning, I need to find 99 other parents, divide them at random into 50 who are going to discipline their children and 50 who are going to bribe them with BOD. That way we can be sure we know what works.
Okay, should we watch 5 minutes of BOD and then come back?
Yes. Here comes BOD.
Want to feel old? Tim Harford's daughter is now 15. And he's not the only one with a daughter. Loyal listeners will be pleased to know that long-time series producer Charlotte MacDonald has given birth to a baby girl. Earlier in the series, we'd tried to calculate the odds she'd have her baby before the end of the Radio 4 series in the UK. Well, she beat those odds, and this week her baby arrived precisely 48 minutes before the due date. So, within the margin of error and on the 90th percentile. Truly a more or less baby. Before we go, we have one more podcast extra, a story about a randomised control trial that led to what some have called the Kenyan Worm Wars.
If you're eating as you're listening to this, well, sorry.
Roundworm, whipworm and hookworm. We know that perhaps more than a quarter of the world's population is infected with one or more of these worms.
This is David Taylor Robinson from the University of Liverpool.
They live in the gut and they're transmitted through contaminated food or directly from soil, and they can burrow through the skin of the feet. And they particularly affect kids living in poverty in areas where there's poor sanitation.
Now, worms are not usually fatal, but they can make children ill and possibly contribute to malnutrition, stunted growth, and absences from school. This has led to the idea that in areas where parasitic worms are common, children should simply be routinely treated. That's a very attractive idea, and many development experts, including the World Health Organization, recommend mass deworming programs as a highly cost-effective way to help poor children. Many discussions of the subject refer to a very famous, very influential study that was conducted in Kenya. The study's authors were two economists, Michael Kramer of Harvard and Edward Miguel of the University of California, Berkeley.
We worked starting in 1998 on a large school-based deworming project.
This is Edward Miguel. He and Michael Kramer set up something called a cluster randomized trial. That means that instead of randomly putting individual students into the treatment group or the control group, entire schools were allocated to one group or the other. Their results showed two interesting findings. One is that for the schools receiving treatment, attendance was much improved.
Another central finding was that even people who did not take the drugs themselves benefited.
But a few years ago, a team of epidemiologists at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine were commissioned to perform a replication, that is, to go back to the original data from Kenya and double-check everything. Their conclusions have finally been published, and here's how The Guardian's headline reported the story.
New research debunks merits of global deworming programs.
So, has the evidence for mass deworming just evaporated? The replication team looked at the original study in two ways. One was a strict replication, basically checking all the numbers and all the sums. The second took the original data but applied the latest epidemiological thinking. The replication did agree with many of the findings of the original study, but they also found some problems. Here's Richard Hayes, senior author on the replication study.
We found that the analysis that the authors had done on indirect effects, they call them externalities. So this is effects on children going to school, not in schools where the deworming was carried out, but in nearby schools where deworming was not carried out. So when we reanalyzed the data again, we found that, in fact, there had been errors in that analysis and that, in fact, when we reanalyzed the data, there was no significant indirect effect in those schools.
Now, the original authors concede that their first paper had an error in it. They thought that schools up to 6 kilometres away from a treated school were gaining some benefits, but that was wrong. But, they say, the data still show clear benefits up to 3 kilometres away. So there are still important spillover benefits, right? Well, Richard Hayes says, no, not so fast. Once an error's been discovered, you can't just go back to the data and fish around until you get a positive result. That's statistically invalid. But Edward Miguel says they're not fishing around in the data. Right from the start, they were checking for benefits at a range of 3 kilometres, 4 kilometres, and so on. Finding one mathematical error invalidates one result, but it doesn't prove them all wrong.
In the original paper, we looked explicitly at 0 to 3 kilometres. So ignoring those 0 to 3 kilometre results is inappropriate in our view.
The replication team and the original authors are actually closer together than some of the excitable press coverage might have you believe. But they're not that close. There are substantial disagreements, and there's been a lot of fierce debate between policy wonks about whether the epidemiologists have performed a rigorous and valuable service, or they've gone out of their way to find fault.
That's all we have time for this week, but thanks to Tim Harford and Professor Sarah Smith. If you spot any figures that don't quite add up, please do get in touch at moreorless@bbc.co.uk. I'm Ruth Alexander. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter, the live show.
Recently, I read an article about how scorpion venom can help surgeons to detect brain cancer. I hope you may want to put this in an episode.
Please welcome to the stage Draco the Scorpion. Whoa, oh my goodness.
So basically they inject this venom, they liquefy their prey.
Liquefy their prey and then they drink it.
Disgusting.
30 Animals That Made Us Smarter from the BBC World Service.
This is such a nerd fest.
It's not like that. It is a nerd fest.
Just search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you get your podcasts.
You guys are so lovely.